Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to Wall Street Unspun. A lot of topics to discuss this hour, so hopefully we can get them all in. And also, we'll be taking your phone calls again. The number to call during the show to ask me questions or to introduce new topics, as long as they're about economics, politics, the financial markets, the telephone number is 800-678-9597. That's a toll-free number, 888-678-9597. First of all, I'll go over some of the topics that I plan on discussing today. Number one is going to be the jobs report that we got on Friday, the very weak jobs report, which was a surprise to Wall Street, which was not a surprise, though, to the listeners of this program. We discussed this at last week's program, that the numbers were going to be much weaker than what the consensus was forecasting. And once again, I was right on that, the same way I was right on the prediction for the GDP numbers for the week prior. Also, we're going to discuss the rate hike from Tuesday. The Fed raised interest rates another 25 basis points. And we're going to talk about the comments that they made with respect to that rate hike. Also, we'll talk about the oil price, which continues to rise. Today, oil closed at a new contract closing high. And that's despite the fact that early in the day, the Saudi government came out and made statements which were deliberately designed to depress the oil price. I think probably they might have gotten a call from the Bush administration asking for some help. So Saudis tried to talk the price of oil down by talking about new supply that they could bring to the market. But the traders put it right back in their faces, and after a dollar sell-off in the price of oil, it rallied back to close at new highs. Also, we're going to talk about the continued weakness of the U.S. stock market, and this is weakness that I had been predicting. And the markets have made new lows this week on the year. The NASDAQ is now off about 12% since the first of the year, and quite a bit more than that since its peak from the bear market rally from last year. So the bear market is back on, and the stock market continues to weaken, so we'll discuss that a little bit. And then the numbers ahead. We've got some economic data coming out Thursday and Friday. Thursday we have retail sales, which I don't think is that significant a number, but most of Wall Street seems to think that it is. The more significant numbers are going to come out on Friday when we get the PPI number, which should be pretty bad. We had a huge increase in oil prices for the month that we're getting the PPI data for. So we should have a pretty big increase in the PPI, although I'm sure Wall Street will once again focus on the core PPI, which excludes food and energy, in other words, the meaningless part of it. And the most important economic data, the merchandise trade deficit or trade deficit report, will come out on Friday. And that's likely to be another all-time record high. And so I want to spend some time today again talking about the trade deficit and really explaining trade and the dynamics of trade and comparative advantage and why this trade deficit that we have is such a problem, and why it's going to continue to weigh on the U.S. stock market, on the U.S. dollar, and ultimately the bond market and our whole economy. So we're going to get to that. So anyway, first of all, let's start in with the jobs data. Last week, I talked at length about the fact that all of the economic data that had been coming out had been weaker than Wall Street had been forecasting for the last several months. Yet Wall Street has refused to ratchet down their expectations for economic growth. And a lot of these rosy projections have come from some of the very strong numbers that we received in the March and April period of the year. Those numbers were aberrations, and Wall Street just doesn't seem to understand that. Those were one-time blips when you had the result of some tax refunds being spent, and you also had the one-time events or the one-time spending which resulted from a wave of refinancing that happened at the end of last year when interest rates actually made their lows for the whole cycle, and there was another massive round of refis. And so you had the refi money and you had the tax refunds that were spent. And that really exaggerated the consumption data for that period of time. And also probably employers might have responded to some of this temporary upsurge by hiring some people. Maybe they believed some of the rhetoric, and we had a blip up in job creation. And all that was just a blip. But Wall Street looked at that data and assumed that the corner had been turned, and now they're disappointed with all the weaker data that they get and all the weak data that they keep seeing every week. They keep attributing that to, a fluke, or this is just a one-time thing, and they keep looking for the growth to return, which really was just fantasy anyway. And I don't know how much longer it's going to take for Wall Street to realize this. And I know a lot of it, too, of course, is wishful thinking and propaganda, certainly on the part of the government. When the politicians keep telling us how great things are, we know that they have an agenda. I mean, certainly the Bush administration isn't going to get reelected by reminding us how bad things really are. In any event, we've got a caller on line one. You want to go ahead, caller? Hello? Is the caller there? Well, apparently not. Anyway, so the jobs data came out, was a disappointment to Wall Street. The stock market responded. We had a significant drop in the stock market on Friday. We did some real technical damage. And, I think that's continued this week. We had a little bit of a blip up on Tuesday in the aftermath of Alan Greenspan's statements. But we reversed all those gains today with some disappointing comments coming out of Cisco Systems and a couple other tech stocks that shed a little reality on the situation. But now getting to the rate hike, and Alan Greenspan raised interest rates now 25 basis points, and I've been calling these measured rate hikes really too little too late. I mean, he's so far behind the curve that he can't even see it. But he had to, as part of his statement, because some people had looked at some of this weaker economic data that we had on jobs and thought that maybe the Fed would back off from its rate hikes in light of the fact that the economy was not as strong as they had predicted. But the Fed is going to have to keep raising interest rates no matter what happens to the economy, no matter how weak it gets, because it's already so far behind the curve. But of course, as part of the Fed's statement today, it talked about, again, how this current soft patch in the economy, which I think it's actually quicksand, it's not a soft patch, but he's attributing this soft patch to higher oil prices and saying that the higher oil prices are temporary, and he still sees a vigorous expansion ahead and thinks everything is great. And the dollar gained a little strength based on those statements, but basically all that is propaganda. I mean, Greenspan is trying to talk up the U.S. economy. He knows that the only thing keeping foreigners in the U.S. currency is their confidence, and a lot of it is confidence in Greenspan himself. And so Greenspan has to exude confidence or instill confidence in America's creditors, and he does that by lying about the fundamentals of the U.S. economy. Because if he told the truth about the U.S. economy, nobody would want to own the dollar. So he comes out there and talks about how great things are. You know, it's interesting, too, that a lot of the other analysts and economists out there are talking about how higher oil prices are responsible for the current slowdown. Now, just, not too long ago, these same analysts were saying that higher oil prices wouldn't affect the economy. I was saying that they were wrong. But now they're wrong again. Because the current slowdown is not because of higher oil prices. I mean, oil prices at the pump are really not up that much in the last few months. I mean, they're up, but they're not up significantly, and that's not the reason that we've seen this slowdown. The reason for the current slowdown is basically consumers are saddled with tremendous amounts of debt that is becoming more expensive to service, and the total amount of the debt is a greater burden. And income is not rising sufficient to meet the higher cost of debt, and so consumers are spending more money on interest and naturally have less money available to spend on other goods. And so the economy is slowing down, and employment in those areas is going to suffer. Ultimately, the higher oil price is going to weigh on the economy at the margin, and it's going to weigh substantially on the economy when the prices move a lot higher, because they are going a lot higher. When they keep talking about $45 in oil being temporary, they're right, it is temporary, but not for the reasons that they believe. Alan Greenspan and Wall Street want us to believe that oil prices are going to fall, but they're going to keep rising. That's why the price is temporary, because it's not going to stay here. It's going higher. And again, as I mentioned in the past, it's not really oil prices moving higher. It's the dollar losing value. And as the dollar becomes less and less valuable, we need to exchange more and more dollars for the same quantity of oil. Anyway, I don't know what happened to the last caller who tried calling in, but hopefully we won't have that problem with any additional callers. The telephone number, if somebody wants to chime in and add something to what I'm talking about or ask a question, it's 888-678-9597. That's toll-free call, area code 888-678-9597. Anyway, so as I said, ultimately the higher oil prices are going to weigh on the economy, but not yet. I mean, this is not the real reason for the slowdown. But Wall Street, and Alan Greenspan don't want to talk about the real reasons for the slowdown. They want to pretend that it's oil prices, because this is something that supposedly is beyond their control, and it's temporary. And so if the economy is only weak because of a temporary blip up in oil prices, then everything must be fine. We don't have to worry. But if they wanted to tell the truth about why the economy is weak, well, then people would have to worry. And that's not what Alan Greenspan is there to do. He's there to instill confidence in America's creditors, and I assume he's there to try to reelect George Bush. That seems to be what his job has been ever since he's been in that office, is to try to help whoever happens to be the incumbent get reelected and just kind of go along with whatever these guys want to do so he can be reappointed. Although I don't know that he's vying for another reappointment, so I don't know why he can't finally, be honest. But in any event, the stock market seems to take its cues now from the oil market as well. I mean, when we had the Saudis coming out today and trying to talk the oil market down by talking about the extra capacity that they have to bring online, which I really doubt is there, and they tried to talk about speculators and trying to say that the crude oil price at its current level is unjustified and it shouldn't be here, and they were trying to warn speculators. I mean, this is all this, talk, all the, jawboning. It's similar to what Alan Greenspan does. I mean, he tries to talk up the economy, and the Saudis are now trying to talk down oil prices. Not that they probably really want oil prices to come down. I mean, think about it. I mean, oil is what they're selling. Their living standard is based on how much money they get for their oil. So I think, if anything, they're trying to play ball with the Bush administration, is probably calling in some favors and is probably trying to get them to do what they can to bring the price of oil down, because I guess Bush thinks that that's what would help the economy, what might help the stock market would be some relief on the oil price, especially since you've got Alan Greenspan out there blaming this soft patch entirely on rising oil prices, which isn't the case. But if it's oil that's causing our problems, if the Saudis can come in and talk down the price of oil, then there might be some optimism that the economy would pick up, the stock market might rally, and that might improve the prospects for Bush to be reelected. But in any event, so the economic data that we have coming going forward now, that we've got the jobs report out of the way, is the trade numbers, the trade figures that are going to be coming out on Friday, and the PPI numbers that are also going to be coming out on Friday. I think those are the big numbers that we're going to get for the week. And unfortunately, really what these numbers mean is going to be ignored. Now, I remember years ago 1987, when the merchandise trade deficit hit $17 billion, which at the time was extremely high. And that was the number that we got right before, or right at the 1987 stock market crash in October. And the dollar had been weakening into that, and we got that trade deficit, and everybody basically panicked. It was just such a disaster. How can a country have a $17 billion trade deficit? And for a while, for years after that, people would be on pins and needles waiting to see what the trade deficit was. And if it came out worse than expected, you'd see a big decline in the dollar. Well, today, no one even pays attention to the trade deficit. I mean, you wouldn't even know it was coming. I mean, sometimes on CNBC, they don't even talk about it, even on the day it comes out. They don't have any commentators in there to explain what the trade deficit means. But now the trade deficit is, not only is it $17 billion, it's almost $50 billion. It's huge. And the merchandise trade deficit is even larger. I mean, the trade deficit got so big that the government stopped reporting merchandise trade, and they started including it within the entire trade deficit, which includes services, not merchandise, for which America enjoys a surplus. And the government has a habit of doing that. Whenever numbers start coming out in a way they don't like it, they change the way they calculate the numbers so they don't look as bad when they report them. And they do that with everything. When it's the savings rate, they used to, when it got to down about 1%, they readjusted what they counted as savings, and all of a sudden the savings rate was 5 or 6% again. And then now that it fell back down to where it is, it's really negative based on the old standard. Or when inflation started to get high, they took housing prices out of the CPI. They started hedonically adjusting things. All sorts of, the government always tries to change the way they calculate the data, and that was what they did with the trade deficit. They used to report merchandise trade deficit. That was getting bigger and bigger and bigger, so they stopped reporting it and started reporting the overall trade balance, which included services. But now even that overall balance is enormous. In fact, it's so big now that nobody even pays attention to it because they figure, well, what's the difference? I mean, it's been so enormous month after month, and it's never caused any problems, so nobody even cares how big it gets. In fact, you even hear the nonsense, and I can tell you, anybody who's listening to the program tunes in to CNBC or CNN and listens to any analysis that might be offered on the trade deficit, it's probably going to come out at either a new all-time record high or close to a record. And what they're going to talk about is how this shows how vibrant the U.S. economy is, how strong our economy is, how much better we're doing than our trading partners. They say because we're so prosperous and we're doing so well that we're buying a lot of products, that we're buying more from our trading partners than our trading partners are buying from us. And the reason they can't buy a lot is because their economy is so weak. And so they spin it around. They try to say that our trade deficit is a sign of how strong our economy is, as opposed to the reality, which is it's a sign of how weak our economy is. That's like, the head of a corporation looking at all their losses and explaining why the losses that the company is running is a reflection of how sound he's running the business. So they turn logic on its head. It's like it's Orwellian, but the public eats it up, and Wall Street just keeps on dishing it out, and like that's fact. And on all these other countries that have these big trade surpluses, like Japan with an enormous trade surplus, well, it's because their economy is in such bad shape. Meanwhile, we used to have huge trade surpluses when our economy really was in great shape. We used to have the largest trade surplus of any nation. And that's certainly not the case any longer. And again, it's these enormous and chronic and persistent trade deficits and, of course, the budget deficit that is ultimately going to drive the dollar dramatically lower. Not just marginally lower, but the dollar is going to lose most of its value. How much of its value depends on some action by the Fed and by the government, whether or not we have hyperinflation where the dollar loses practically all of its value, or if it just loses most of its value. But those are the only two alternatives that the dollar has. And what's keeping it afloat right now are the foreign central banks and rhetoric and speculators. You've got Alan Greenspan and you've got Wall Street constantly talking up the dollar and talking about how great the prospects are for the U.S. economy when nothing could be further from the truth. but that keeps buying interest in the currency. But once I think we break below 80 on the dollar index, which is about another 10% below its current level, the dollar index will break into uncharted territory, all-time record lows, and I think that's when it will come under real serious attack. I think you'll see a lot of dollars being liquidated, a lot of repatriation of foreign money out of U.S. funds, and then the dollar will really start its slide. And then the question is, what is the Federal Reserve going to do about it? Because the only thing that they can do would be to dramatically increase interest rates to try to reward foreigners or encourage them to hold our currency. And again, they're going to have to make the rates very, very high to offset for the risk of the continued decline in the currency. That's what happened in 1980 when Paul Volcker had to raise short-term interest rates up to 21%. Now, it wasn't that Volcker woke up one morning and they figured, hey, what's a good interest rate to set? Well, let's go for 21%. That was what they had to do. I mean, they had to bring them up that high to encourage the Europeans and the Asians to keep buying our dollars in light of the fact that we had a lot of inflation here and there was a lot of currency risk. Well, we've got a lot more inflation now and a lot more currency risk and a much bigger current account deficit to fund. How much higher are interest rates going to have to go to convince our creditors to fund it? And the problem is we're not the country that we were back then. We have an enormous national debt that's funded with treasury bills. We have a public that's loaded up with adjustable rate mortgages. And we have corporate America with a tremendous amount of short-term floating rate debt. Everybody is hooked on these low interest rates. And if we had to raise interest rates to any significant degree, the economy couldn't withstand it. And the consumer spending, which is 80% of the economy, two-thirds of the economy, would collapse. GDP would contract dramatically. And now all of a sudden, the trade deficit, instead of being 5 or 6% of GNP, could be 10 or 15% of GNP, because the GNP would get a lot smaller. So it's just going to be a real mess. And, of course, the budget deficit is going to explode under that scenario, because when the economy contracts, the government collects less revenue. The government has to spend more money for funding their programs. They get less tax revenues, and of course the government has to pay more in interest on its on the national debt. So in any event, I don't know if we're having any technical difficulties here, but in any event, so when interest rates rise and the budget deficit is impacted by that and the economy is impacted, you know, that's going to cause money to flee the U.S. And interest rates, you know, higher interest rates might not even be enough to attract people back into the dollar, which is, you know, the basic reason for what we're doing at Euro Pacific Capital, which is trying to get our clients' money out of U.S. dollars and into the currencies in other countries where the governments are being a lot less irresponsible than the U.S. government and where the central banks are being a lot more responsible. A perfect example of a country that we invest in is New Zealand. We've got a lot of our client money invested in New Zealand assets. And there was some new economic data this week that came out of New Zealand. We saw the New Zealand unemployment rate fall to almost a 20-year low. It's down to 4%. And the economy is growing nicely. Short-term interest rates, their equivalent of our federal funds, is 6%. 6%. We're 1.5%, and they're 6%. Imagine what would happen to the U.S. economy if we had short-term interest rates of 6%. But the New Zealand has a real viable economy. That's why they can have those interest rates. They can, you know, they can withstand them. Our economy can't. And you've got a 450 basis point yield advantage in that country. Certainly a lot of capital is going to flow into New Zealand, and it's going to keep driving the New Zealand dollar higher. And there are a lot of great stocks to buy down there. If you don't already own any, you can certainly call up and we can discuss this with you. The number to call off the air to discuss individual stocks that we like in New Zealand that pay high dividends, as well as stocks in other countries around the world that pay dividends, you call the 800 number, 800-727-7922. I'll repeat that number again. It's 800-727-7922. Or you can also visit the website for Euro Pacific Capital, which is www.europac.net. europac.net. And again, to call this program and speak with me live and ask questions, the toll-free number there is 888-678-9597. That's 888-678-9597. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about trade. Because we're going to have this trade number that's coming out, I really want to talk about the idea of trade and why nations trade, because trade is a very misunderstood concept, even among Nobel Prize-winning economists, to say nothing about the Wall Street economists. Very few people understand. A lot of people think that the reason you export, for example, is to create jobs, when nothing could be further from the case. I mean, creating jobs is not, as I said before, is not the goal of an economy. It's to eliminate the need for jobs. You don't want to do something just because you have to work, right? I mean, people prefer leisure to work, and the idea for an economy is to have less work and more leisure. But the reason that nations or individuals trade is with one another is because somebody has a comparative advantage. Somebody else can do something more efficiently than you can and expend less labor. So if people in another country can produce a product at a lower cost or with less labor, then there'd be no reason for me to do it, and we could trade. So that's what happens. I mean, you have comparative advantage in one country or another, and everybody produces what they produce best, and they exchange with one another, and every country is better off because they all got more goods with less effort. And I use an example when I give seminars to explain trade, and I use an example of farmers. I take an example of two farmers. I say, let's say Farmer Smith makes apples and Farmer Jones grows oranges. And the reason that they don't, grow each is because, let's say, Farmer Smith has land that's ideal for orange, for apples, and Farmer Jones's land is perfect for oranges. Both farmers want both fruit, but they realize if each one grows only the fruit that is most suited for their farm or their orchards, that each person will end up with more. So the one farmer, Farmer Smith, grows apples, Farmer Jones grows oranges, and they exchange with one another. Now, what would happen, let's say, in a situation where Farmer Jones has a tornado that comes through his orchard, and his whole crop is destroyed one year, and it comes time to exchange with Farmer Smith, and Farmer Jones says, "I don't have any oranges. I mean, I wiped out. Would you sell me some of your apples on credit? I'll give you extra interest, so I'll give you an IOU for the apples I would normally give you, for the oranges I would normally give you, rather, and I'll give you an IOU for some additional oranges." Now, Farmer Smith figures, well, he's got more apples than he can consume anyway, and Farmer Jones is a good guy, and I'm sure he's good for it, so he says, okay, I'll take your IOU for the oranges and for the interest. Now, the reason he's accepting the IOU is not because he wants the piece of paper with the world's IOU on them. He's accepting them because he ultimately wants the oranges that those IOUs represent, oranges that Farmer Jones hasn't yet produced, but that he's obligated to produce under the terms of this IOU. Well, let's say another year goes by, and another natural disaster hits Farmer Jones, and again, he comes to Farmer Smith without any oranges and makes the same deal and offers his IOUs instead of oranges, and Farmer Smith takes it again. Now, I mean, the point that I'm trying to make is, let's assume this goes on and on. At some point, Farmer Smith forgets why he's exporting all these apples to Farmer Jones. He forgets that he's doing it to earn oranges and thinks he's doing it to earn IOUs. He's just so used to collecting them that he thinks he's getting rich because he's got these IOUs. And pretty soon, Farmer Jones basically says, hey, this is great. I get all these apples. I don't have to grow any oranges, I don't have to work. It beats farming. So let's say he decides that he's not going to even grow any oranges. He's going to be a service sector economy, and he turns his orange orchard into a golf course, and he just plays golf all day. And every year he exchanges IOUs with Farmer Smith, and says he's got a service economy, and he's living on these imports. But it's unsustainable because the only reason he's eating is because Farmer Smith has taken his IOUs, which are clearly worthless because he no longer has an apple orchard. He has a golf course there. But maybe Farmer Smith, is able to take those IOUs from Farmer Jones and exchange them with other farmers in the community. He's able to go ahead and pass them off and buy other things that he needs because maybe Farmer Jones has a good reputation in the community. And when other individuals see those IOUs for oranges, they say, oh, yeah, I know Farmer Jones. I'll take that IOU for those oranges. You know, but at some point, somebody has to realize that the orchard is gone and the IOUs are worthless. This is the situation that the United States is in today. The United States, Americans, pay for imported products from all over the world. But how do we pay for them? We don't pay for all these consumer goods that we import by exporting other consumer goods that we produced. What we're doing is we're telling the world, just like Farmer Jones, we didn't produce any goods this year. Will you accept our IOUs plus interest? And they're doing it. So we haven't, all these imports that we have, we actually haven't paid for them yet. We're buying them on credit, right? The way we technically pay for imports is through exports. That's how a nation pays. We import something of value and we export something. You know, when we import something from Japan, where the Japanese expend scarce resources to produce it, where they use land, labor, and capital to produce a product and give it to Americans, we're supposed to have to use some of our resources to produce a product to give to them. But what do? We just print up a piece of paper, put a number on it, and hand it to them. It costs next to nothing. And, you know, the Japanese or the Chinese or whoever we're trading with, they don't think they're doing this, to be a benefactor. They don't think this is charity. They're accumulating these IOUs because they think they're actually worth something. They still think we have an industrial economy that is capable of producing enough goods that we can export to make these to make good these IOUs. They haven't noticed that Farmer Jones has turned his orange orchard into a golf course. They don't see all the factories that have shut down, that there's no possible way that we can produce enough goods to ship to Japan and China to pay them for all the goods that they have already shipped us, to say nothing about all the interest that we owe them. Because, of course, when we're paying them later, we're giving them interest, which represents additional claims on U.S. production. So this is a huge, huge problem, and nobody seems to realize this on Wall Street, just what this trade deficit means. You know, they also are going to talk about the fact that, well, sure, we have a trade deficit, but we have a current account surplus. They say that the reason we have a trade deficit is because people all around the world are so anxious to invest in U.S. government bonds that they have to sell us all these products so that they can get the dollars to buy our government bonds. This is all a bunch of nonsense. I mean, they've got it backwards. They've got the tail wagging the dog. It's not that foreigners are so desperate to buy our bonds that they have to sell us goods. It's that they're buying our bonds because they're sold us so many goods, and we don't have any goods to sell them, so they're buying our bonds because they have no other choice. And they also feel that if they stop buying our bonds, the dollar will collapse, Americans will no longer be able to consume anymore, and they won't be able to export their products to us, which is actually the best thing that can happen to them, but they don't want to admit it. Because it doesn't do them any good to continue to manufacture products and give them to Americans who can't pay for them. You know, it's a giant vendor financing. I mean, I talk about this also in seminars, but a lot of people, if you remember, back in 2000, during the Internet bubble, a classic example of this vendor financing gone bust was in the telecommunications sector, where you had companies like Cisco Systems and Nortel Networks and Juniper and a number of companies that were selling all sorts of expensive telecommunication equipment to startup.com companies and other little telecom companies. Now, these companies didn't have any money to pay for this stuff, so the Ciscos and the Nortels sold it to them on credit. They loaned them the money to buy their products. And then, of course, they booked all this income as if it was real earnings. But they had no hope of ever getting paid for this because the companies had no money. They were operating at losses. And when they all went bankrupt, these companies had to write these losses off. It was vendor financing. Well, you know, and the more, you know, they pretended they had profits, but they were just deluding themselves. And that's the same thing that's going on when the Chinese and the Japanese are exporting all of these products to Americans, and they're pretending they're making money just collecting IOUs, but they're never going to get paid. We're not going to be able to export anything. Now, certainly, they can try to redeem these IOUs with real physical assets in the United States. They could try to use them to acquire U.S. real estate or, you know, things like that. But when that finally happens, the dollar is going to be collapsing in value, and prices are going to go through the roof because there are going to be all these dollars rushing to buy up everything in America. That's not nailed down. And, of course, there's a lot of risk when they do that because there's sovereignty issues. If foreigners start buying a lot of, you know, U.S. real assets, and they can't vote in our elections, they run the risk of having those assets confiscated. I mean, I'm surprised they're already not talking about the political risk associated with owning U.S. assets when foreigners already own more than 50% of the marketable U.S. Treasury debt. That's a very dangerous position to be in, to own all this government debt, but where you can't vote in the election. But anyway, this is a big issue that is misunderstood, is going to be completely spun the wrong way on Friday when the data comes out. But people have to realize how significant these trade deficits are. What they really reflect is the amount of goods that America gets from the rest of the world but doesn't pay for, and all these IOUs are mounting offshore. And the main reason that you've got so much intervention now, you know, on the part of foreign central banks is because the private demand for dollars is drying up. And as all these exporters are earning U.S. dollars, from selling to America, and they go in to exchange those dollars for their own currencies, it's the central banks that are stepping up and taking the other side of these transactions. And if those central banks weren't there, you know, warehousing all these U.S. IOUs, the dollar would already be in free fall. And, you know, some of the data that's been coming out recently has been showing that the propensity for the Japanese to buy dollars has certainly diminished in the last month or so. We'll see what happens. I mean, we'll see what happens if the yen really starts to take off, if the Bank of Japan is in there big, buying again with both hands, or if they really have cooled off on their intervention, which could spell big problems for the U.S. Because we already can't really fund. The only way we're able to fund these current account deficits right now is based on the foreign central banks. And it's interesting that when you listen to Alan Greenspan talk, he talks about the fact that he sees no evidence that the U.S. is having any trouble funding its current account deficit. Now, I don't know what he calls foreign central banks being the major buyers of dollars to see that he sees no evidence that we're having trouble funding it. Because if we were having no trouble funding it, there would be no need for all this foreign central bank intervention. They're only intervening because private demand is insufficient. So that already means that people who are investing their own money don't want to buy U.S. dollars. It's only foreign central banks who are investing taxpayer money, who don't really care what happens, who are willing to step up to the plate and buy. So that should be substantial evidence for Greenspan. But again, Greenspan doesn't speak the truth. Greenspan just says what he thinks the markets want to hear. Because again, he's just like a propaganda minister. His job is to create a false sense of confidence, to tell people how great things are. You know, you think about, he's like that Tariq Aziz, who was the information minister in Iraq, who when we can see on CNN, you know, all these tanks in Baghdad, and he's saying, oh, everything is fine. You know, he's just saying, you know, Alan Greenspan is no different than that guy. I mean, his job is not to tell the truth to the public. His job is to confuse the public. His job is to create a false sense of prosperity, to create a false sense of confidence in the U.S. economy, in the U.S. dollar, so people will keep lending us money, so everything can keep on going. But again, as I mentioned before, his success is ultimate failure, because the longer Alan Greenspan can keep this Ponzi scheme going, the worse it's ultimately going to be. You know, the longer he can keep the world lending us money, the more we owe, and the bigger the ultimate collapse is going to be, and the more important it is for the listeners to this program, for clients of Euro Pacific Capital, to not have their money in U.S. dollars. That is the unfortunate situation that we're now in, that we as Americans, even though we live here, we can't save U.S. currency. There is no reason to do that. There's no reason to believe that the dollar is going to maintain anywhere near the purchasing power that it currently enjoys. And the sad thing is, the longer that Greenspan can keep this going, you know, the worse it's going to be, and the more important that it is that people take action today to protect themselves. And the way you protect yourself from what's going to happen is you don't save currency. You don't save dollars, right? When you're saving money, the act of saving means to refrain from consuming. You're taking some of the money that you could have consumed, and you're setting it aside to hopefully fund future consumption, whether it's consumption during retirement or, you know, consumption, you know, for children's education or, you know, other future expenses. But the only way you can do that is if you're holding a currency that maintains its purchasing power. Because if the currency that you're saving is losing purchasing power, when you go to actually spend it, maybe, you know, you would have been better off just spending the money while you had a chance instead of putting it away for the future when it might have minimal value. So if you're going to put some money away from the future, you've got to make sure that the currencies that you're choosing to save are, you know, are not going to be diminished like that. So you got to look at some, you know, currencies in Europe. You got to look at the euro. You can look at the Swiss franc. You can look at the British pound. You can look at the Australian and New Zealand dollars. And you can look at the Singapore dollar and the Japanese yen. And you can find investments in those countries that will provide you with a meaningful rate of return that will hold up against U.S. inflation. And, you know, you want to look for high dividends. You want to look for interest and payments that are coming in those currencies. And as the U.S. dollar loses value and those currencies appreciate, the dividends or the interest income that they're throwing off in terms of dollars will rise for you. And so will the value of the principal. And that will help offset the rising cost of living that's going to be more and more obvious to people as time goes by, despite the best propaganda efforts of the U.S. government and Wall Street to convince the public that there's no inflation. And, you know, whenever the government is vehemently denying that there's a problem, there's one thing that you can be sure of, and that there's a problem. And that's why they're denying it so vehemently. So you've got to think for yourself. You've got to look beyond the propaganda from Wall Street and from Washington. Most of it self-serving, and they've got vested interest to dish it out. But you've got to have sense enough to understand what's really going on and to take actions to protect yourself. And we can certainly help you do that. We've already done a lot of the research. We've identified the companies around the world that we believe to be conservative, that will deliver dependable dividends, which could rise over time. And we can discuss the specific securities in detail with individuals who want to call my office. There are brokers in the office now, and they'll be here, you know, pretty much, you know, all the time during business hours on the West Coast. But my toll-free number is 800-727-7922. That's 800-727-7922. And again, you know, we haven't had any calls at all this program except for the one that I lost. I don't know. Hopefully there are actually people listening to the program, and I'm not just talking, you know, to myself here. But if you want to participate, if you want to ask me a question on the markets, if you have questions on your own investments, if you're wondering if you should buy or sell, you know, a particular investment, you know, anything, whether it's stocks, whether it's real estate, any question that you have on the economic data that's come out, any are on the market, either what happened in the preceding week or what's happening this week or what I think is going to happen next week, you know, give us a call. It's a toll-free number. The number is 888-678-9597, and that's the number to call to talk live on the program. Again, the number is 888-678-9597. And if any of you listening, you know, if you have friends who have missed the program and you think there's something that I said that's of interest, you can remind them that this particular program, as all the previous programs, will be available to listen on demand on the website at www.europac.net. That's www.europac.net. And people can go there and replay this broadcast on demand. And ultimately, all the broadcasts, the first two shows that I did and this show, will be archived on the website. Anyway, apparently now I do have a caller, so go ahead, caller. Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, I had to give you a call anyway just to let you know that there are people out there listening to you, first of all. I feel bad no one's called in. I just got a call from a friend. He told me to turn on the station and listen to your program, and I like what I'm hearing. What do you advise? I currently am positioned in physical gold and silver and some mining stocks, and I'm very concerned about, you know, the status of the country with all these alerts and all this stuff. What advice do you have other than what you were just previously saying about investing monies into foreign currencies like, you know, the pound sterling or the Swiss franc?
Well, I mean, those are the reason I like the, you know, the currency-based investments is because they do provide very good dividend yields. And other than gold, you know, gold is more of a all or nothing bet, in my opinion. I mean, if I'm right on my scenario, and I'm confident that I am, the gold price is going to go through the roof, and gold stocks will ultimately do even better. But if I'm wrong, right, you know, I mean, gold could fall. And the beauty of my strategy of having my clients invest in very conservative foreign assets is even if I'm wrong, they're still good investments. I mean, if somebody is listening to the program and they're not sure if I'm right, hey, maybe the U.S. dollar isn't going to collapse. Maybe the U.S. economy isn't going to fall into this deep depression that I think. What's the worst-case scenario? If I'm wrong and you take your money out of the U.S. dollar anyway and invest it in foreign countries that have less inflation and better growth rates than we do, probably the worst-case scenario is you're still better off than if you kept your money in the U.S. You're going to get a better dividend yield and you're going to get a better overall return, even if I'm wrong.
Right.
But if I'm right and the dollar collapses and you don't take my advice, it's a disaster.
Oh, no. Well, that I know for sure. Holding U.S. funds is not a smart thing.
Warren Buffett, look what Warren Buffett, it just was announced this week that he's upped his position in foreign currencies now to $19 billion, up another $8 billion from the prior quarter.
Right.
If you look at all some of the most successful investors in the world, whether it's Warren Buffett, whether it's Jimmy Rogers, whether it's Bill Gross, whether it's
Soros,
yeah. You know, John Templeton, all these guys are saying and doing the same thing. They're getting rid of their U.S. currency. They're accumulating currencies in Europe and Australia, New Zealand and Canada, and they're telling other people to do the same thing.
Would you mind just taking a second out and explaining the derivative market? I have a handle on it, but I think a lot of listeners might not really understand how things are leveraged to the extent that they are, like 20.
I'll get to that in a second.
Okay, sure.
What I want to talk about briefly, though, is your question on gold. I'm glad you're buying physical gold. I recommend it. You might not be aware, but I think the best way to buy gold is through a program that we're participating in through the Perth Mint in Australia. And you can get details about the Perth Mint program on my website at www.europac.net. But basically, what this program enables you to do is buy and sell physical gold, silver, and platinum, basically at the spot price. And there is no storage costs, no shipping costs, no insurance.
Are you kidding me?
It will be kept for you in a government-owned mint in Australia, where the account is guaranteed by the government of Southwestern Australia, which has a AAA credit rating. The account is not reportable on a tax return as a foreign bank account. And I think it's the safest way to own physical precious metals, because if things really get bad in the United States and the U.S. government tries to confiscate it or tries to make it illegal to take gold out of the country, your gold is already safely in Australia. And, you know, it's just the lowest cost, least commission, best way to own and buy and sell physical precious metals. And if you're not already participating in that program, you can call us up and we can talk off the air about the details, or you can read about it on our website. As far as derivatives are concerned, there's a tremendous amount of derivatives out there, and it's going to be a huge problem because people do not understand and appreciate the counterparty risk associated derivative contract, because you have all these Wall Street firms insuring against all this risk through derivatives, but they don't understand that the other side of these derivatives are not going to be able to make good when it hits the fan. You know, it's like, if you buy fire insurance and only one house burns down, the insurance company has no problem paying. But if all the houses they insure burn down, they don't have enough money. So you've got all this, all these derivatives out there where people have portfolio insurance, they have puts on the stock market, they have puts on the bond market, they have put, you know, they have all these positions to protect their portfolio. But in a major collapse, the guy on the other side of those transactions who has taken in all this premium, who has been paid to underwrite all, he can't afford it. It's going to be a disaster. I mean, the derivative problem is enormous. But that's a topic probably for another program, because it would take the entire hour to really explain the dynamics of the derivatives and the risks that they pose to the U.S. economy. But anyway, I thank you for the call, and we've got another caller on the air now as well, too. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I was wondering if you could address the, my question, and I'll take it off the air. If you could address the question of the Federal Reserve putting emphasis on the federal funds rate instead of the discount rate in order to give them more leeway in case later on we need to drop the rate more.
Yeah, I don't know when they started to focus more on the Fed funds rate rather than the discount rate, but they raised both rates recently, and it's interesting that the discount rate is actually higher now than the federal funds rate, and I don't think that used to be the case. The federal funds rate is basically the rate that banks charge one another for overnight lending, and the discount rate is the rate that the Federal Reserve would charge a bank for actually borrowing directly from the Federal Reserve itself, as opposed to other member banks. But in any event, the rates are much, much too low. I mean, they're basically giving away money. And what this has done is facilitated this carry trade, where the banks and the brokerage community are able to borrow at low interest rates and use the borrowed collateral to invest in long-term government bonds, mortgage-backed securities, and make the spread using enormous leverage, and they're making a tremendous amount of money. But this whole thing is going to blow up when interest rates really rise and the value of all these long-term debt collapses that are collateralizing the carry trade. All of a sudden, there's going to be a rush for the exits, and a lot of people are going to go broke, and interest rates are going to go through the roof. And this is a real disaster waiting to happen. And it's one of the reasons that we're getting our money out of the dollar, because we want to be out of the dollar before this happens. Because if you're still in the dollar when this happens, it's too late to get out. Anyway, we've got one more caller, and we're starting to run out of time, so let's take the next call.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. A question. I'm considering investing in property in South America and Central America, just to spread out some of my money, because right now I have it in the stock market. I have it in my, my 401K, and I want to own some property, and I want to retire and live in South America when I retire, and I'm wondering, what's your thought on buying property in those places?
Well, do you have an account with us right now?
No, I don't.
Yeah, well, number one, the first thing you need to do is get out of the U.S. stock market. You told me you have money in the stock market. If you want to retire, you need to get that money out of the stock market quick, while there's still something left, because we're still in the bear market and we're going a lot lower. Now, as far as accumulating property, I think in general, residential property pretty much around the world is overpriced, particularly here in parts of the United States. But in general, I find residential properties to be overpriced right now. What I think you want to do is we're accumulating commercial property, which I think is kind of fairly valued to undervalued in most parts of the world, and we're doing it through publicly traded real estate trusts, both in Australia, New Zealand, and in Europe and Asia. And those particular trusts will give you very high dividend yields. That's what I would be accumulating now, rather than trying to buy, maybe residential property in Latin America, if that's ultimately where you're going to live. There are also a lot of problems, I think, in Latin America, and getting out of the U.S. into some of these countries is almost like getting out of the frying pan into the fire.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to invest outside the United States for safety, and there's not a lot of history of sound money policy in Latin America. And it's interesting because, 100 years ago, Argentina was one of the three or four wealthiest countries in the world. And they basically wiped themselves out for the same reasons that America is going to be wiping itself out. But I would strongly recommend that what you do is you call me at my office and talk to either me or one of my brokers at 800-727-7922. We can discuss the stocks that you own, which ones need to be sold right away, which ones maybe you can hold, and we can talk about structuring a portfolio for you out of the country in foreign assets that will enable you to retire in Latin America. Because the only way you or anybody listening to this show is going to be able to retire is if they have a portfolio that doesn't include, that it isn't U.S. dollars. Because on U.S. dollars, no one's going to be able to afford the cost of living. It's going to be too high.
Right.
So you got to get a portfolio in foreign assets, and the sooner you can do it, the better.
Okay. I'll have to give you guys a call then.
Yeah, and again, it's 800-727-7922.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Well, that's good. So in any event, we had a few callers coming in, which at least showed me that I wasn't talking to myself. But again, you know, for the next time, you know, I think we're running out of time to take any additional callers. But anybody who's repeat listeners to remember, oh, there's still one more caller on the line, so let's go to the last caller. Hello?
Yes. I had asked you a question previously about the federal funds rate and discount rate. I was just wondering, as far as your take on the economy as a whole, I'm a real estate appraiser, and it seems like the values of real estate is skyrocketing, and I was wondering if that's if you consider that a bubble compared to the stock market bubble?
Oh, I think the real estate bubble is even far bigger than the stock market bubble was, because people are buying real estate with nothing down. I mean, people had to put money down to buy stocks, and,
right.
You know, when you buy real estate, you have to make your mortgage payments. I mean, people didn't have to make these payments. We are running out of time, but this is a topic maybe for the next program. The real estate bubble is enormous. A Fed policy right now is designed to perpetuate that bubble. And the only thing that's keeping it afloat right now is excessive credit. Real estate appraisers like yourself, who are really more like internet analysts, who are putting ridiculous evaluations on houses, and people are able to borrow against those ridiculous appraisals. And people are buying houses with adjustable rate mortgages, negative amortization mortgages, nothing down. Particularly here in Orange County, this is the biggest property bubble around. And I think that could be a good topic for next week's program to discuss the real estate bubble. In the meantime, I thank everybody for listening. This has been Wall Street Unspun, and I'm Peter Schiff, the president of Euro-Pacific Capital. And I look forward to seeing you all again, or talking to you all again next week. Please tell your friends to tune into the program. I want to get as big an audience as possible. Thanks again, and talk to you in a week.